Imagine losing like your entire career, your license, and honestly, your livelihood, just because you clicked the thumbs up button on a client's LinkedIn post.
Right. It's brutal.
It sounds totally ridiculous, I know, but in the world of financial regulation, these invisible tripwires are basically everywhere.
Oh, absolutely everywhere.
So today we are doing a deep dive into the absolute deadliest minefield on the Series 65 exam. We're mapping out the rules of client communications, contracts, and, well, advertising.
And it is a minefield.
Totally. But before we get into the survival guide, a quick heads up for you listening. This deep dive is brought to you by CertFuel.
Awesome resource, by the way.
Yeah, they're fantastic. They've got a full Series 65 course with like adaptive study quizzes, smart flashcards, and unlimited practice exams that are actually weighted just like the real thing. It's essentially the antidote to test anxiety, you know. Check it out, certfuel.com.
Highly recommend it.
So getting back to these invisible tripwires, I feel like that's a perfect way to frame this whole topic.
It really is, because the regulatory landscape, it isn't just a list of arbitrary don'ts, you know? Every single rule on this exam exists because someone, somewhere in history, found a highly creative way to rip a client off.
Right. Someone had to ruin it for the rest of us.
Exactly. And when you understand the specific grift that a rule was designed to stop, you actually stop memorizing. The regulations start to feel like, well, architectural safeguards rather than just bureaucratic red tape.
I am so glad we're approaching it this way because my ADHD brain absolutely rejects standard textbook reading.
Oh, I totally get
Like,
that.
if I have to stare at another page listing subparagraph C, clause 4, my eyes are going to glaze over permanently.
It's dry material for sure.
Right. So, to make this actually stick in our brains so we can recall it under exam pressure, we need a narrative. We
Man,
need stakes.
I like where this is going.
So, we are going to follow the chaotic careers of three recurring characters today. Imagine this as like a high-stakes financial sitcom.
I am intrigued. Who is our cast?
Okay, character number one is Frank the founder.
Okay.
He is the well-meaning, big-hearted, but constantly blundering head of Frank's financials.
Right, a classic
Yeah,
type.
he's an SEC registered advisor. He genuinely cares about his clients, but he's just a little bit clumsy with the compliance manual.
A very familiar archetype in the industry, the visionary who hates paperwork.
Exactly. Sometimes he sends emails without thinking. Sometimes he makes promises he probably shouldn't.
We all know a Frank.
We really do. Then across town, we have Slick Sammy.
Ah, Sammy.
Sammy is a state registered advisor. He wears heavily starched collars, a little too much cologne, and he is relentlessly hunting for a marketing loophole.
Oh boy, the exact reason state administrators never sleep.
Yeah, if there is a gray area in the Uniform Securities Act, Sammy is basically pitching a tent and living inside it. He wants maximum clients with minimum disclosure.
A dangerous combination.
And finally, the prize they are both fighting over, cautious Clara.
Okay, the client.
Right, Clara is our target client. She inherited a massive trust fund, but she brings like a binder full of worst-case scenarios to every single meeting.
I've had clients exactly like Clara.
Right. She's terrified of market crashes. She's terrified of hidden fees, and she asks a million questions. So our mission today is to watch Frank and Sammy try to win Clara's business without accidentally committing a federal crime.
That is a fantastic premise. And naturally, the first step in this journey, it isn't the contract, right? It's the courtship.
Got to get him in the door first.
Exactly. Before Frank or Sammy can manage Clara's money, they have to get her attention. They have to pitch themselves. So this plunges us straight into the deep end, the SEC marketing rule and the definition of an advertisement.
Okay, so I feel like advertisement in normal life just means a billboard or, a Super Bowl commercial. But my gut tells me the SEC doesn't define it that simply.
Not even close.
I'm assuming it's incredibly broad. Like, if Frank wears a t-shirt with his company logo to the grocery store, is that an ad?
You are actually closer than you think with that logic.
Wait, really?
Well, the SEC marketing rule defines an advertisement as essentially any direct or indirect communication an investment advisor makes to more than one person.
More than one person, okay.
Right, or to one or more persons if it involves hypothetical performance that offers the advisor's investment advisory services.
Okay, so it's about offering the services.
Exactly. And here's the kicker. It covers communications to prospective clients and current clients.
Wait, current clients.
Yes.
I thought an ad was just to get new business. Like, if Clara is already Frank's client, how is he advertising to her?
because he might be trying to cross-sell her a new service.
Oh, I see.
Yeah, so if she is currently in a basic fixed income portfolio and Frank sends out a blast email to his existing clients offering a brand new high-fee options trading program, that is an offer of new advisory services.
So that's an ad.
That communication must follow all the advertising rules, yes.
I totally see the trap there. But let's look at the more than one person part because I want to test a scenario.
Let's hear it.
Let's say Frank, the founder, is at a charity gala, right? And he ends up sitting next to Cautious Clara.
Okay.
They chat. She mentions she needs someone to look at her trust fund, and she gives him her business card.
Standard networking.
Exactly. So the next morning, Frank sits at his desk, and he types out a highly personalized single email directly to Clara. He outlines a custom strategy just for her specific tax situation, and he hits send. Does that trigger all the massive SEC advertising compliance rules?
No, that is safely excluded.
Oh, good for Frank.
Yeah, under the first prong of the definition, one-on-one communications are excluded from being defined as an advertisement. What Frank just sent is considered correspondence.
Correspondence, got it.
Right. And the regulatory burden for correspondence is much, much lighter than for a formal advertisement.
Okay, let me push the boundaries on this then.
Do it.
What if Frank realizes he met like 50 wealthy people at that gala? He's exhausted. He doesn't want to write 50 custom emails.
Uh-oh. I know where this is going.
So he writes one generic email. He says, hey, it was great meeting you. I run Frank's Financials. We use a proprietary momentum strategy that mitigates downside risk. Let's set up a call.
Okay.
He puts all 50 email addresses, including Clara's, into the BCC line and hits send. Did he just cross the line?
He vaulted over the line.
Oh, man.
The moment that communication offering advisory services goes out to more than one person, that one-on-one exclusion vanishes. It is officially an advertisement.
Just because of the BCC.
Just because it went to multiple people. Frank now has to retain that email under the books and records rules. He has to ensure it doesn't violate any of the general prohibitions we'll talk about. And his compliance officer is basically going to have a heart attack if he didn't run it by them first.
Wow. Okay, this brings up the most terrifying tool in the modern advisor's arsenal, which is social media.
Oh, yes. The ultimate trap.
Because by definition, social media destroys the one-on-one concept, doesn't it?
Right.
Like if Frank posts on his LinkedIn feed, I'm taking on new clients for my wealth management practice, that's visible to his 500 connections.
And potentially thousands more, depending on the algorithm. Yes. The exam will heavily test the social media trap.
I bet.
A social media post visible to the public inherently counts as reaching more than one person. Therefore, an open social media post offering advisory services is an advertisement, period.
Okay, listener, I want you to pause and think about this specific scenario. Direct question for you.
Listen closely to this one.
Slick Sammy goes on Facebook. A prospect named Dave posts on his own wall, I just inherited an IRA from my aunt and I have no idea what to do with it.
Classic Dave.
Sammy sees this, and Sammy replies directly to Dave in the public comments section of Dave's post. He says, hey, Dave, I specialize in inherited IRAs. I can set you up with a great tax-deferred growth strategy. Call my office.
Okay, so a direct reply.
Give yourself a beat to think about it. Is Sammy's comment an advertisement or one-on-one correspondence?
It's a tricky one.
Okay, so what's the answer?
Well, the instinct might be to say it's one-on-one because Sammy is replying specifically to Dave, right?
Yeah, that makes sense.
But the reality is because Sammy placed that reply in a public comment section where anyone else on Facebook could see it, it is a broadcast. It is an advertisement.
Boom. That is such a sneaky distinction.
It really is.
So if Sammy had sent Dave a direct message, like a private DM,
yeah,
that would be correspondence. But because he did it in public, it's an ad.
Precisely. And this is why firms require advisors to use approved archived platforms for social media. If you are communicating in public, you are advertising.
All right. So let's say Frank accepts this reality. He knows his LinkedIn post is an advertisement. He knows his mass email to the gala attendees is an advertisement.
He's accepted his fate.
He submits them to compliance. What are the actual boundaries of what he can say? The study materials talk about the 7 general prohibitions.
Yes, the big 7.
But I don't want to just read a list. I want to know the philosophy behind these.
Well, the philosophy is simple, honestly. Do not deceive the client, either actively or passively.
Makes sense.
Let's look at the first 2 prohibitions, because they are basically 2 sides of the same coin. Prohibition number 1, you cannot make any untrue statement of a material fact. That's just basic fraud. You can't say your firm manages $1 billion if it only manages $10 million.
Sure, no lying. That seems obvious. What's the flip side?
Prohibition number two is where people get caught. You cannot omit a material fact if leaving it out makes the surrounding statements misleading.
I want to dig into this concept of omission, because we always hear that omission is fraud. But what does that practically look like?
Okay, imagine Slick Sammy is pitching a municipal bond fund to Cautious Clara.
Perfect.
He puts up a slide showing that the fund generates a 5% tax-free yield. That is a completely true statement. The fund does yield 5%.
Okay, so he's not lying.
Right. But Sammy omits the fact that the underlying bonds are issued by a municipality that just filed for Chapter 9 bankruptcy, and the bonds are currently trading at 30 cents on the dollar.
Wow. Okay, so the 5% number is technically accurate based on the par value, but leaving out the impending default makes the 5% number completely deceptive.
Exactly. The omission weaponizes the true fact.
Weaponizes a true fact. That's a great way to put it.
And this transitions perfectly into another major prohibition, which is fair and balanced treatment.
Fair and balanced.
Yeah, you are prohibited from discussing any potential benefits of your services or methods without providing fair and balanced treatment of the material risk.
Oh, let me guess how Sammy tries to get around this.
Go for it.
Sammy posts a video about how his aggressive options trading strategy made his clients 40% returns last year. At the very end of the video, for half a second, a screen flashes with microscopic text that says, "Investing involves risk of loss." Is that fair and balanced?
Not even close.
Shocking.
The SEC explicitly states that the risks must be presented with equal prominence to the benefits.
Equal prominence, okay.
You cannot bury the risks in a footnote. You cannot flash them on the screen faster than a human can read. And you cannot use dense, unreadable legalese to mask the danger. If you spend 3 minutes hyping the upside, you must dedicate meaningful, clear time to explaining the downside.
Claire would definitely appreciate that. Like, if Sammy says 40% returns, Claire is immediately going to ask, okay, but how much could I lose?
Naturally.
And Sammy is legally obligated to tell her clearly and prominently you could lose your entire principal.
Yes. And this ties directly into how performance advertising is heavily regulated, because another general prohibition is cherry picking.
Ooh, let me build a scenario for this one.
Please do.
Frank, the founder, has been running a growth portfolio for 5 years. Years 1 through 4 were terrible. He lost money.
Typical Frank.
Right. But year five was incredible. The market rallied, his tech picks exploded, and the portfolio was up 60%.
A great year.
Frank decides to run an ad. He creates a beautiful bar chart that only shows the results of year five. He calls it the Frank Growth Strategy, 60% annual returns.
That is textbook cherry picking, and it is a massive violation.
Yeah, that feels super deceptive.
You cannot present performance results in a manner that is not fair and balanced. So, to prevent exactly what Frank just did, the SEC requires that if you show performance, you must show it for standard time periods.
Which are what?
1 year, 5 year, and 10 year periods.
Ah, so Frank can't just isolate his one good year. He is forced to show the 5 year number, which would average out all those terrible early years, and show Clara the actual, much lower reality of his long term strategy.
Exactly. And if the portfolio hasn't existed for 10 years, you show 1 year, 5 year, and since inception. You are locking the advisor into standardized windows so they can't artificially carve out a timeline that makes him look like a genius.
That is smart. I see another massive trap in the performance advertising rules, too. Gross versus net performance.
Oh, a huge exam topic.
I assume gross is before fees and net is after fees. Why does the SEC care so much about this? If Frank made Clara 10% in the market, isn't that the performance?
It is the performance of the investments, but it is not the reality for the investor.
What do you mean?
Imagine Frank charges a massive 2% annual advisory fee. If the gross performance is 10%, Clara doesn't get 10%. Clara gets 8%.
Right, because Frank took his cut.
Exactly. The SEC's position is that gross performance is a fantasy number. It is money the client never actually touches.
So if Frank runs an ad, can he show the 10% gross number as long as he puts a little asterisk that says fees not included?
Absolutely not. The rule is incredibly strict. Whenever you present gross performance, you must present net performance with equal prominence in a format designed to facilitate comparison.
Meaning they have to be right next to each other.
Side by side in the same font size. You cannot hide the fee drag. The client must instantly see the difference between what the market yielded and what actually landed in their pocket.
That is a phenomenal protection for Clara. Okay, pattern interrupt. shake it out.
Aching the breath.
We're about to wade into the most heavily tested, most contradictory, and most dangerous area of the advertising rules.
Yeah.
This is like a five-alarm fire for the Series 65 exam.
Okay. All right.
Testimonials and endorsements.
Ah. This is where understanding jurisdiction becomes a matter of life and death for your exam score.
Let's lay the groundwork first, because we hear these words used interchangeably in regular life, like, oh, that celebrity endorsed my product, or I read a customer testimonial. In the legal framework of this Series 65, how do we pull these two concepts apart?
It all comes down to the relationship the speaker has with the advisor. A testimonial is a statement given by a current client regarding their experience with the advisor.
Current client equals testimonial.
Right. And an endorsement is a statement given by a non-client third party.
Okay, let's apply this to the cast. Cautious Clara is a current client of Frank's. She loves him. She writes a letter saying, Frank's financials secured my retirement. That is a testimonial. Now, Frank has an accountant named Dave. Dave does the corporate taxes for Frank's firm, but Dave does not invest his personal money with Frank.
Okay.
Dave tells a prospect, Frank is a highly organized, brilliant financial mind. That is an endorsement.
Exactly right. Current client equals testimonial. Non-client equals endorsement.
Okay. Got it. Now for the history lesson. For decades, my understanding was that advisors simply could not use testimonials. It was a blanket ban. You couldn't have Yelp reviews. You couldn't put quotes on your brochure. Why was it banned for so long?
Well, the original logic was that investing isn't like buying a toaster, you know?
Right.
If Clara made a lot of money with Frank, it might just be because they happened to invest during a raging bull market. Her success isn't necessarily reproducible for the next client.
That makes sense.
Regulators believe that letting one lucky client shout about their gains would mislead prospects into thinking they were guaranteed the exact same results.
It's basically the past performance does not guarantee future results philosophy applied to human beings.
Yeah.
But that rule changed recently, right?
It did. The SEC completely overhauled the marketing rule. They finally recognized the reality of the internet age. People rely on reviews. So the SEC now permits the use of testimonials and endorsements, but only if the advisor navigates a rigorous obstacle course of disclosures.
Let's watch Frank navigate that obstacle course.
Mm-hmm.
Frank is SEC registered. He wants to put Clara's glowing testimonial right on the homepage of his website. What does he have to disclose?
He must clearly and prominently disclose three specific things right alongside Clara's quote. First, he must disclose that Clara is a current client.
Okay, that's easy.
Second, he must disclose whether Clara was compensated in any way for the testimonial. And third, he must disclose any material conflicts of interest resulting from the relationship.
Wait, what counts as compensation? Is it just handing Clara a briefcase full of cash?
Oh, it is far broader than that. Cash, obviously, yes. But what if Frank says, hey, Clara, if you let me use your quote on my website, I'll knock your advisory fee down from 1% to 0.5% for the next year.
Oh, wow.
That is non-cash compensation. It is a massive financial incentive.
Yeah, that's real money.
Right. If someone is reading Clara's review, they need to know she was basically paid to write it via a fee discount. That completely changes how much weight a prospect might give to her praise.
And there are thresholds too, right? What if Frank pays a podcaster $5,000 to read an endorsement of his firm?
That triggers the promoter rules.
The promoter rules.
Yes. If an advisor pays a promoter more than $1,000 in cash or non-cash compensation over a 12-month period, there must be a formal written agreement in place.
Over $1,000 written agreement.
The advisor also has to oversee the promoter to ensure their marketing complies with the SEC rules.
Huh.
Furthermore, there is a bad actor disqualification.
Meaning what?
Meaning you cannot pay someone to endorse you if they have certain disciplinary histories, like a recent conviction for securities fraud.
Well, that seems like a good rule. So it seems like a lot of hoops, but at least Frank has a pass to do it.
Yeah.
He puts the disclosures in bold text, he checks the promoter rules, and his website looks great.
He's fully compliant.
Now, here comes the trap. Slick Sammy is watching Frank's website. Sammy says, wow, testimonials are legal now. I'm going to do the exact same thing.
Oh, no.
Sammy, who is state registered, puts a glowing review from his client on his homepage, complete with all the SEC disclosures. What happens to Sammy?
Sammy gets a cease and desist letter from the state administrator and potentially loses his license.
Wait, why? He used the exact same disclosures Frank used.
Because of the jurisdictional divide, this is huge.
Probably.
The SEC changed its rule for federal covered advisors like Frank.
Oh.
The SEC does not write the rules for state registered advisors. Most individual states still operate under the older NASA model rules, which strictly prohibit the use of testimonials for state registered advisors.
Oh my gosh. Okay, listener, lock this into your brain right now. The exam is going to throw a scenario at you where an advisor uses a testimonial perfectly with every possible disclosure.
Every single.
The entire question hinges on one word. Is the advisor SEC registered or state registered?
Exactly.
If they are SEC registered, the testimonial is likely legal. If they are state registered, it is illegal. You have to read the question carefully to spot the jurisdiction.
It is one of the most elegant traps on the exam because it tests your reading comprehension and your understanding of the dual regulatory system simultaneously.
Okay, what about third-party ratings?
Let's hear it.
Slick Sammy goes online and pays a marketing company $500. A week later, he gets a shiny brass plaque in the mail that says, voted number one wealth manager in the tri-state area.
Of course he does.
He mounts it on the wall right behind his desk, so Clara sees it when she walks in. Is that allowed?
That is highly deceptive. Third-party ratings are only permitted if they come from an independent, neutral source that provides such ratings in the ordinary course of its business.
So no buying trophies online.
You cannot just buy an award from a vanity press. Furthermore, Sammy would have to clearly disclose the methodology used, the time period the rating was based on, and crucially, whether compensation was paid directly or indirectly to obtain the rating.
So if Clara asks, hey, who voted you number one? Sammy has to admit, well, I paid a guy on the internet $500, which completely ruins the illusion.
Which is exactly the point of the disclosure requirement.
Okay, we have successfully run the gauntlet of the initial pitch. Frank sent a compliant email. He didn't cherry pick his performance. He handled the testimonials correctly.
He survived.
The marketing worked. Cautious Clara walks through the glass doors of Frank's financials. She sits down in the leather chair across from Frank's desk. The courtship is over. Now, Frank has to formally introduce himself and his firm, and we enter the perilous territory of unlawful representations and disclosures.
This is where the informational asymmetry between the professional and the retail client is most heavily policed.
Let's start with the scenario involving Slick Sammy again. Sammy is meeting with a different prospect. He hands a prospect a heavy gold embossed business card. Right at the top, under his name, it says in bold letters, Administrator Approved. He leans across the desk and says, look, I know investing is scary, but you don't have to worry. I submitted all my investment models and my resume to the state securities administrator. They reviewed everything. They verified my skills and they granted me my registration. The state itself says, I am competent to manage your money.
Sammy is basically committing a criminal offense under the Uniform Securities Act right there.
Let's dissect why. Because it sounds reassuring to a client. Why is the state so furious about that statement?
Because it is a fundamental misrepresentation of what registration actually is. This is the core prohibition regarding unlawful representations. Registration does not imply approval.
It does not imply approval.
Right. The administrator's job is to ensure you filled out the forms correctly, paid the filing fee, and don't have a disqualifying criminal record. They are processing paperwork. They are not vouching for your investing genius.
Wait, so the state administrator doesn't look at Sammy's trading strategy and say, wow, this is a really solid plan for municipal bonds. Let's approve him.
Never. The administrator does not verify the accuracy of the information you file, and they absolutely do not pass judgment on the merits of your competence or the quality of your investments.
So Sammy is lying.
If Sammy tells a client that the state approved his skills, he is falsely borrowing the sovereign authority of the state government to make himself look trustworthy.
I think we need a mechanism-driven analogy here. How do we make this concrete?
Okay. Think about a restaurant health inspector versus a Michelin star food critic.
Oh, I like this. Keep going.
When a restaurant gets a license from the city health department, what does that mean? It means the inspector verified there are no rats in the kitchen and the chicken is stored at the correct temperature.
Right. It's safe.
That is registration. The city is authorizing them to open their doors. But the city health department is not saying the food tastes good. They are not recommending you eat there for your anniversary.
Obviously not.
If the restaurant owner puts up a sign saying, city government approved for culinary excellence, that is a lie. The Michelin star critic is the one who judges competence and quality. The government only judges baseline legal compliance.
That is brilliant.
Yeah.
Registration is the rat inspection. It is not the Michelin star. So what is Sammy legally allowed to say about his status?
He can state the objective fact. He can say, I am registered as an investment advisor representative in this state.
Just the fact.
That is a true statement of his legal status. He just cannot add the qualitative spin that the registration means he is approved or endorsed.
Let's talk about another way advisors try to borrow authority. The alphabet soup of letters after their names.
Oh, this is a good one.
Frank the Founder prints new letterhead. It says, Frank the Founder, RIA, Registered Investment Advisor. He thinks it looks incredibly professional. What is the problem here?
The problem is that RIA is a registration status, not a professional designation.
But people use it all the time. You see it on LinkedIn profiles everywhere.
And regulators despise it. Presenting a registration abbreviation like RIA or IIR for Investment Advisor Representative as if it were an earned credential is a deceptive practice.
How is it different from someone putting CFA or CFP after their name?
Night and day difference. To get a CFA Chartered Financial Analyst or a CFP Certified Financial Planner, you have to study for hundreds of hours, pass brutal multi-day examinations administered by an independent certifying body, prove years of relevant work experience, and adhere to a strict ethical board.
So it's real work.
It is an earned credential that signifies a high level of specialized competence.
And to get an RIA.
You fill out Form ADV, pay a fee, and file it with the SEC or the state. It is a corporate filing.
That's it.
That's it. Putting RIA after your name is like putting LLC after your personal name as if it makes you smarter. It is misleading because it tricks the client into thinking you achieved a rigorous academic milestone when you merely filed corporate paperwork.
Okay, listener, direct question for you. Let's see if you can spot the trap. Frank realizes he can't use RIA, but he did study really hard for his licensing exam. So he orders new business cards that say, Frank the Founder, Series 65 Certified.
Oh.
He passed the test. He has the score report. Is he in the clear? Take a second to think about it.
I bet they know this one.
What's the verdict?
It is the exact same trap. He is not in the clear.
Because the Series 65 is a license, not a certification.
Precisely. Passing the Series 65 is a minimum competency exam administered by FINARA on behalf of NASA. It satisfies a state's requirement to grant you a license to operate. It is not a certification issued by a professional board.
So what can he say?
Frank can accurately say, I hold a Series 65 license. But calling himself Series 65 certified elevates a baseline entry requirement into a fake professional designation.
Okay, so Clara is sitting across from Frank. She ignores the business card. She gets right to business. She says, Frank, before I hand you my trust fund, I need to know everything. How do you get paid? What are your conflicts of interest? Are you going to sell me mutual funds that pay you a secret commission?
She's sharp.
This brings us to the bedrock of the entire industry, the fiduciary duty and the disclosure of material facts.
The fiduciary duty is the highest standard of care in the law. It means the advisor must act entirely in the best interest of the client and must provide full and fair disclosure of all material facts.
I assume a material fact is anything involving hard numbers, right? Fees, costs, historical returns. If it's not a number, it doesn't matter.
That is a very dangerous assumption. The legal standard for materiality is much broader and more subjective. A material fact is defined as any piece of information that a reasonable client would consider important in making an investment decision.
So it's not just numbers. Let's stress test this. Frank is going through a terrible divorce. Is that material? Does he have to tell Clara?
Generally, no. Personal life events are not material unless they directly impact his ability to manage her money.
Okay, what if Frank has a side business? He manages money during the day, but on nights and weekends, he is a licensed insurance agent.
Okay, conflict alert.
And he often recommends that his advisory clients buy fixed annuities, well, from him, which generates a massive commission for his side business. Is that material?
Absolutely. That is a glaring conflict of interest. If Clara is taking his advice to buy an annuity, she needs to know that Frank is financially incentivized to make that specific recommendation.
His objectivity is compromised.
Exactly. If she didn't know about the commission, she might think he was recommending it purely for its investment merits.
And as we established earlier, failing to tell her about the insurance gig, even if he doesn't actively lie about it, is fraud by omission.
Correct.
So how does Frank physically communicate all of these complex material facts? He can't just expect Clara to remember a six-hour conversation.
The mechanism for disclosure is Form ADV, specifically Part 2 of Form ADV, which is universally referred to as the brochure.
The brochure.
Historically, ADV was just a massive impenetrable checklist of legal jargon, but regulators realized clients couldn't understand it. So they mandated that Part 2 must be written as a narrative in plain English, discussing the firm's business practices, fees, and conflicts of interest.
Let's break down the anatomy of Form 80V, because there was Part 2A and Part 2B, and they cover different things. Listener, here is a memory trick to keep them straight. 2A is for the advisory firm. It covers the entity, the big picture, the firm's overall fee schedule, the types of clients they take, their broad investment strategies, and the firm-wide conflicts of interest.
Yes. And 2B is the brochure supplement.
Right. 2B is for the body, the specific human being sitting across the desk from you.
Exactly. Clara is hiring Frank's financials, the firm, but she is taking advice from Frank himself, the human. Part 2B provides Clara with Frank's specific educational background, his business experience, and crucially, any disciplinary history. If Frank had his license suspended 5 years ago for unauthorized trading, it goes in Part 2B.
Okay, so Frank has his 2A and 2B printed out and stapled together. When does he actually have to hand this stack of paper to Clara?
The delivery timelines are highly testable, particularly under the NASA model rules for state-registered advisors. The rule provides the advisor with two options for initial delivery. And I want to emphasize, it is an either a framework. You choose option one or option two.
Let's start with option one, the proactive approach.
Option one is pre-delivery. The advisor delivers the brochure to the client at least 48 hours before the client signs the advisory contract.
Let's dig into the psychology here.
Yeah.
Why exactly 48 hours? Why not an hour before?
Because of the vulnerability of the client in a high-pressure sales environment.
Oh, interesting.
Imagine Slick Sammy gets Clara in his office. He dazzles her with charts, he hypes up the potential returns, and he creates a sense of FOMO, fear of missing out. Then he drops a 40-page legal document in front of her, full of complex fee formulas and conflicts of interest, hands her a pen, and says, "Sign this right now so we can get started."
She would be too intimidated to read it, or she wouldn't have the capacity to process the conflicts while he's staring at her.
Precisely. The 48-hour rule is a mandatory cooling-off period before the legal commitment. It forces the advisor to hand over the disclosures and say, "Take this home, read it on your couch, talk to your spouse, sleep on it for 2 nights.
That breaks the spell.
It breaks the momentum of the hard sell. If the advisor does this, they have fulfilled their delivery obligation.
But business doesn't always move that slowly. Claire is in Frank's office right now. She has a checkbook in her hand. She wants to start today. Frank doesn't want to send her home and risk her changing her mind over the next 2 days. What is option two?
Option two allows the advisor to deliver the brochure at the time of signing the contract. But to compensate for taking away the pre-signing cooling off period, the rule requires a post-signing safety net.
Okay, what is it?
The client must be explicitly given the right to terminate the contract without penalty within 5 business days of signing.
Ah, so you either give them 48 hours to evaluate it before they are bound, or you bind them immediately, but give them a 5-business-day escape hatch to experience buyer's remorse and walk away completely unscathed.
Yes. The regulatory goal is achieved either way. The client gets a window of time to digest the material facts without being locked into financial consequences.
And the exam trap here.
The exam loves to create a hybrid monster of these two rules. A question will ask, what is a required delivery procedure for the brochure? And a decoy answer will say, the advisor must deliver the brochure 48 hours in advance and provide a 5-day penalty-free termination window.
Which is false. You don't have to do both. It's either the 48 hours prior or it's signing with the 5-day out. Don't let the exam convince you that the strictest sounding answer is the right one.
Exactly.
Okay, so Frank uses option two. He hands Clara the brochure, she signs, and he puts the 5-day escape clause in the contract. Time passes. A year goes by. Frank's business evolved. He adds a new fee tier. Does he just send Clara an email saying, hey, things changed?
No. Form ADV must be updated annually. And this introduces the dual deadlines of the annual updating amendment. At the end of the advisor's fiscal year, 2 separate clocks start ticking. 1 clock for the regulators and 1 clock for the clients.
Listener, let's see if you know the clocks. When does the state administrator or the SEC need the updated filing? And when does cautious Clara need to receive her copy? Think about the timelines.
It's a classic test question.
So who gets it first?
The first deadline is for the regulator. Within 90 days of the end of the advisor's fiscal year, the advisor must file the annual updating amendment to Form ADV.
So if Frank's fiscal year ends on December 31st, he has until the end of March to get his paperwork filed with the state?
Correct. But Clara does not get it in March. The second deadline is for the client. Within 120 days of the fiscal year end, the advisor must deliver the updated brochure or a summary of material changes with an offer to provide the full brochure to all existing clients.
90 days for the regulator, 120 days for the client. Why the 30-day gap? Why not just send it to everyone on the same day?
Think about the logistics. The firm needs to finalize its financial numbers, draft the new language, and get it approved by compliance and filed by day 90. Regulators want to ensure the filing is actually in the system and accepted before the firm starts mass mailing documents to thousands of retail clients.
That makes practical sense.
The extra 30 days give the firm the administrative breathing room to execute the mail merge, print the summaries, and physically or electronically distribute the information to the client base by the end of April.
The exam will absolutely throw March 31st or 90 days at you as the answer for when the client needs it. Remember, regulators eat first. They get it at 90 days. Clients eat second at 120 days.
Excellent way to remember it.
So Clara has survived the disclosures. She read the brochure. She understands the conflicts. The 5-day penalty-free window has expired and she didn't walk away. She is officially ready to let Frank manage her money. But before Frank can legally execute a single trade on her behalf, he has to build a legal fence around her account. We need to look at the actual advisory contract.
The contract is the central nervous system of the advisory relationship. The Uniform Securities Act and the Advisors Act dictate exactly what must be in it.
So if Frank just writes on a napkin, "I will manage Claire's money for 1%, and they both sign it, that's not going to fly.
Not even close. Let's walk through the mandatory elements. First, under state rules, the contract must be in writing.
Okay, basic.
Second, it must contain a detailed description of the advisory services to be provided. Is Frank just giving financial planning advice? Or is he actually managing the portfolio? Third, it needs a specific term. Is it a 1-year contract? Month to month.
What about the money? Clara wants to know exactly how much Frank is bleeding her for.
The contract must explicitly state the advisory fee and the formula for computing it. It also must state the amount of any prepaid fee to be returned in the event of early termination.
Oh, like a refund policy.
Exactly.
Yeah.
If Clara pays $1,200 upfront for a year of service and fires Frank after 6 months, the contract must outline how she gets her $600 prorated refund.
Let's dive deep into one specific highly tested clause discretionary authority. Frank wants to be able to trade in Clara's account while she is on a cruise ship without having to call her for permission every time.
That is discretionary authority. It means the advisor has the power to decide which security to buy or sell, the amount of the security, and the timing of the transaction without consulting the client first. If the contract grants this massive power to Frank, it must be explicitly stated in the document.
Okay, I want to construct a wild scenario here.
Go ahead.
Frank is getting a little nervous. The market is volatile, and his stock picks have been questionable lately. He is terrified Claire is going to sue him if the portfolio tanks. So Frank has his lawyer draft a custom clause on page 14 of the contract. In tiny font, it reads, "The client, cautious Clara, agrees that if Frank's financials loses money due to negligent investment recommendations, Clara waives her right to pursue legal action or arbitration under the Uniform Securities Act."
Wow.
Clara, exhausted by the paperwork, signs the bottom of page 14. A year later, Frank negligently blows up her account. Does that clause protect him?
Absolutely not. What you just described is an exculpatory clause. It is an attempt to exculpate or clear the advisor of blame or liability. And under the law, it is completely void.
But she signed it. It's a contract. Doesn't the signature mean she agreed to the terms?
This is a fundamental principle of securities law, the prohibition on the waiver of client rights. No advisory contract may require a client to waive any rights or protections granted to them under the USA or the Investment Advisors Act.
Let me make sure I understand the magnitude of this. Even if she initials the specific paragraph, even if she signs it in front of a notary public,
it does not matter. A signed waiver waives nothing. You cannot contract your way out of a fiduciary duty.
Why are the courts so aggressive about this?
Because of the asymmetry of power. Historically, sophisticated financial institutions would bury these waivers in 50-page agreements, knowing retail clients wouldn't understand them. The client would just sign where they were told. If courts enforced those waivers, the entire regulatory framework of client protection would collapse. Advisors would essentially become immune to the law just by printing a magic paragraph. So regulators treat the exculpatory clause as if it is written in an invisible ink. It simply does not exist legally. Clara retains her full right to sue Frank into oblivion.
A signed waiver waives nothing. That is a brilliant anchor for the exam. Let's talk about the fees again. Clara is very risk-averse. She doesn't want Frank day trading. She tells him, Frank, I just want you to build me a portfolio of boring, stable, blue-chip dividend stocks, and I want to hold them for the next 20 years.
Okay, buy and hold.
Frank says, great, I have the perfect product for you. It's a wrap fee program. It's so simple. Instead of paying me an advisory fee and then paying a broker a commission every time we buy a stock, we just bundle it all up into one flat fee of 2% of your assets per year.
And here is where Frank the fiduciary needs to take a hard look in the mirror, because a wrap fee might be a disastrous recommendation for cautious Clara.
I see wrap fee tested everywhere. Let's unpack the mechanism. What exactly is inside the wrapper?
A wrap fee program bundles several distinct services into one single, all-inclusive percentage fee. It wraps together the investment advice, the execution of the trades, the clearing, and the custody of the assets.
So the appeal is simplicity. One fee to rule them all. No getting nickel and dimed on a $15 commission every time Frank rebalances the portfolio.
Exactly. For a highly active trader, a wrap fee can be incredibly cost-effective. If Frank is executing 20 trades a month for a client, paying a flat 2% wrap fee might be vastly cheaper than paying a separate commission on all 240 trades a year.
Okay, so why did you say it's disastrous for Clara?
Think of a wrap fee like signing up for an unlimited gas subscription for your car for $500 a month.
Okay, an unlimited gas subscription.
If you are an Uber driver putting 4,000 miles on your car every month, that $500 unlimited subscription is a fantastic deal. You are maximizing the value of the bundle. But what if you are cautious, Clara? What if you only drive your car to the grocery store once a week?
She might use $20 worth of gas a month, but she's paying $500.
Exactly. Clara told Frank she is a buy and hold investor. She might execute 2 trades a year. If Frank puts her in a wrap fee program, he is charging her a premium price for unlimited trade execution that she will never use. This is called reverse churning.
Reverse churning. Wow. Regular churning is trading too much to generate commissions. Reverse churning is doing zero trading, but charging a high flat fee for the privilege.
Yes. A fiduciary must evaluate if the wrap fee is actually suitable for the client's trading profile. If Clara pays a 2% wrap fee when she could have just paid a 1% advisory fee plus two $10 commissions, Frank has failed his fiduciary duty.
That makes total sense.
Regulators audit wrap fee accounts heavily to look for these inactive orphan accounts that are being bled dry by the bundled fee.
That analogy makes it so clear. You don't buy the unlimited gas subscription if you don't drive. Okay, let's look at another mandatory contract clause assignment, the no assignment without consent rule.
Highly testable.
Let's jump 10 years into the future. Frank, the founder, is exhausted. He wants to retire to a beach in Florida. Slick Sammy approaches him and says, Frank, I'll buy your entire firm. I'll buy the building, the computers, and your entire client list. Frank says, deal.
Right.
Can Frank just transfer Clara's contract to Sammy?
Absolutely not. This is a vital protection under the Advisors Act. You cannot trade clients like baseball cards.
You cannot trade clients like baseball cards. I love that.
When Clara signed that contract 10 years ago, she didn't hire a faceless corporate entity. She hired Frank. She trusted Frank's specific philosophy, his background, his risk tolerance. If Frank sells his firm, or if he merges with another firm, or if he transfers the contract to a different entity, that constitutes an assignment. And the law is explicit. No advisory contract may be assigned without the client's consent.
So Clara gets a veto. If she doesn't like Sammy, she can refuse the assignment, take her money, and walk away.
Correct. Clara must affirmatively agree to become Sammy's client.
Now, let's dive into the absolute weed-level edge cases of assignment. Because the exam is going to try to trick the listener with partnership structures.
Oh, the partnership math. Let's do it.
Frank operates Frank's financials as a partnership. Frank owns 70% of the firm. His junior partner owns 30%. The junior partner decides to leave the industry to become a professional surfer. He sells his 30% stake to Slick Sammy. Does Clara have to give consent for that?
No, she does not. This introduces the classic majority versus minority distinction for partnerships. The regulatory test for assignment hinges on the concept of control. Has the controlling block of the firm changed hands?
In this case, no. Frank still owns 70%. He's still calling the shots. He still dictates the investment policy.
Exactly. Because it was a change in a minority interest, 50% or less, the structural control of the firm remains intact. Therefore, the law dictates that this is not an assignment.
So Frank doesn't have to say a word to Clara?
Not quite. While it is not an assignment and consent is not required, Clara still has a right to know who owns the firm managing her money. For a minority change, the advisor must provide written notification to the clients within a reasonable time.
Okay, let's flip the math. Frank is tired, but he doesn't want to retire completely. He wants Sammy to take over the heavy lifting. Frank sells 51% of his firm to Sammy and keeps 49% for himself.
The moment that transaction crosses the 50% threshold, it is a majority change. The voting control of the firm has fundamentally shifted from Frank to Sammy. Sammy is now the boss. The SEC and state regulators view a change in majority control as an assignment of the contract. Therefore, Clara's explicit consent is required.
Listener, burn this matrix into your brain. Minority change, 50% or less, equals notification only. Majority change over 50% equals assignment, which equals consent. What happens if Frank dies unexpectedly? Is that an assignment?
That is a fascinating edge case. If Frank is a sole proprietor, meaning it's just him, not a partnership or a corporation, and he dies, the firm essentially ceases to exist in its current form. If his estate tries to sell the client list to Sammy, that is absolutely an assignment and requires client consent. The clients don't automatically transfer to whoever buys the deceased advisor's book of business.
The control of the relationship always rests with the client. Let's look at one more fee structure before we leave the contract section. Frank is feeling aggressive. He says, Clara, I believe in my tech stock strategy so much that I'm not going to charge you an AUM fee. I'll work for free, BTT. I want 20% of any capital gains I make for you. If I make you $1 million, I keep $200,000. If I lose money, I get nothing.
And with that pitch, Frank has likely violated the restriction on performance-based fees.
Let me challenge this. Why is that illegal? From Clara's perspective, it sounds like the ultimate alignment of interests. Frank only eats if he kills. He has skin in the game. Why do regulators hate this?
It creates a massive moral hazard. It looks like an alignment of interests, but it actually incentivizes catastrophic risk-taking. It is the classic heads I win, tails you lose scenario.
Walk me through the mechanics of that risk.
Let's say Frank is managing $100,000 for Clara. If he plays it safe and makes her 5%, she gains $5,000, and Frank's 20% cut is a measly $1,000, not worth his time.
Right.
But what if Frank takes her entire $100,000 and bets it on a highly volatile pre-revenue biotech penny stock? If the stock moons and goes up 1,000%, the account is worth $1 million, and Frank walks away with a $200,000 payday.
Huge upside for Frank.
But what if the biotech company goes bankrupt the next day? The stock goes to zero. Clara loses her entire $100,000 life savings. What does Frank lose?
Frank loses, well, nothing. He just doesn't get paid. He shrugs and moves on to the next client.
Exactly. Because Frank doesn't share in the losses, a performance fee encourages the advisor to swing for the fences with someone else's money. Regulators generally ban performance fees because retail investors cannot absorb the asymmetrical risk of an advisor gambling for a massive payout.
That makes perfect sense.
Mm-hmm.
The risk is completely skewed. But in securities law, there is an exception to every rule. Are performance fees ever allowed?
Yes. The primary exception is for qualified clients. The regulatory logic is that if a client is wealthy enough and theoretically sophisticated enough, they can absorb the potential downside of a speculative strategy. They don't need the government protecting them from aggressive fee structures.
Okay, listener, direct question time. This is pure memorization, but it is heavily tested. What are the specific financial thresholds that make a client a qualified client under the SEC rules? You only need to hit one of the two numbers. What are they? Take a second to recall.
Gotta know these numbers.
Right, what are they?
The two pathways to becoming a qualified client are based on assets under management or net worth. A client qualifies if they have at least $1.4 million in assets under management with that specific advisor, or they qualify if their net worth is more than $2.7
million. $1.4 million AUM with the advisor, or $2.7 million net worth. Now, there is a massive caveat attached to that net worth calculation, isn't there?
A crucial caveat. When calculating that $2.7 million net worth, the client must exclude the value of their primary residence. You do not count the equity in their home as part of their wealth.
Why not? If Clara owns a house free and clear, that's an asset. Why does the SEC ignore it?
Because of the painful lessons learned during the 2008 housing crisis, being house rich does not mean you have liquid capital, and it certainly does not mean you have the financial sophistication to survive a hedge fund wiping out your portfolio.
That's a really good point.
Imagine a teacher who bought a house in California in 1980 for $100,000. Today, that house might be worth $3 million, but the teacher only has $50,000 in a savings account.
If you include the house, she has a $3 million net worth. She looks like a financial titan on paper.
Exactly. But if Frank puts her into a risky performance fee strategy and loses her liquid savings, she can't pay her grocery bills with the drywall of her house. Illiquid housing wealth does not protect a client from market risk. Regulators want to see actual investable liquid wealth before they remove the safety rails.
Let me throw a math trap at you that the exam might use. Let's say Clara only has $900,000 invested with Frank. So she fails the $1.4 million AUM test.
Right.
But her total net worth, completely excluding the value of her mansion, is $3 million. Does she meet the definition of a qualified client?
Yes, she absolutely does. The rule is an either test. You do not need to meet both. Because her net worth exceeds $2.7 million, she crosses the threshold. Frank is legally permitted to charge her a performance-based fee.
Brilliant. Okay, we're moving into the final phase of the relationship.
Mm-hmm.
Clara signed the contract. Frank has the money. The portfolio is built. But the market gets choppy. The news is full of doom and gloom. Clara is terrified. She calls Frank in a total panic. She says, Frank, I can't sleep. I need some reassurance. Just promise me I'm not going to lose my money.
And this is where Frank, out of a misguided desire to be a nice guy, might accidentally commit fraud. We are entering the strict prohibition on performance guarantees.
Let's say Frank wants to comfort her. He says, Clara, take a deep breath. Look at my track record. I guarantee you won't lose a single dime with this portfolio.
If he utters those words, he has violated the anti-fraud provisions of the Investment Advisors Act. Both state and federal rules strictly prohibit an advisor from guaranteeing a client that a specific investment result will be achieved.
Funny, I want to play defense attorney for Frank here. Frank didn't put it in a marketing brochure to trick a stranger. Clara called him crying and demanded the guarantee. She essentially held a gun to his head and said, I will pull my money out today if you don't promise it's safe. Doesn't the fact that the client initiated the request change the legality? Is there a client-requested exception?
That is a very common defense, and it fails 100% of the time. There is absolutely no such exception. The client begged me to guarantee it is never a valid legal shield.
Why is the prohibition so absolute?
Because no one can predict the future. Markets carry inherent, unerasable risk. Any promise that removes the reality of that risk from a client's mind is fundamentally deceptive. If Frank guarantees the account against loss, he is theoretically shifting the market risk from Clara's shoulders onto his own. That completely distorts Clara's decision-making process.
Oh, I see.
She might agree to take on wild leverage or aggressive tech stocks because she falsely believes Frank is magically immunizing her from the downside.
Okay, what if Frank is a little more subtle? He knows he can't say the word guarantee. So he says, Clara, look, we have a robust hedging strategy using put options. Worst case scenario, if the entire market collapses, I promise you will at least break even.
You just walked directly into the exam trap. A promise to break even is still a performance guarantee.
Because zero loss is still a specific number.
Exactly. Promising a specific minimum outcome, which is what breaking even is identical in the eyes of the law to guaranteeing a 10% gain. Both are promises of a specific result that the advisor has no power to control. Break-even guarantees are strictly prohibited.
Okay, listener, if you see the phrase break-even on the exam, red flashing light should go off in your head. It is a prohibited guarantee. But let me push back on the broader concept. Is Frank allowed to guarantee anything at all? What if Clara is just generally unhappy? Can Frank offer a satisfaction guarantee?
This is a vital distinction, and it hinges on what is being guaranteed. The prohibition is strictly on guaranteeing investment outcomes. It is not a ban on guaranteeing the quality of professional service.
Give me an example of a legal guarantee.
Frank can tell Clara, Clara, if you are ever unhappy with my communication, if I don't return your phone calls within 24 hours, or if you feel my financial planning advice was subpar, I guarantee I will refund your 1% advisory fee for that quarter.
Oh, so he is refunding his own paycheck.
Yes. Refunding his advisory fee has absolutely nothing to do with the performance of the underlying stocks in the market. It is a customer service money-back guarantee, just like you would get from a plumber or a mechanic. That is perfectly legal. He just cannot guarantee that the portfolio itself will produce a gain or avoid a market loss.
That is such a clean dividing line. Investment results versus service quality. You can guarantee your own labor. You cannot guarantee the S&P 500.
Exactly.
Okay, as a final bonus topic to wrap up the regulatory landscape, let's step briefly outside the world of investment advisors and look at broker-dealers. Slick Sammy also holds a broker-dealer license. Broker-dealers have a very specific disclosure document called a fee schedule. How does a BD fee schedule differ from the IA disclosures we've been talking about?
Broker-dealers face a much narrower, more specific disclosure requirement for their standardized account and service charges. We aren't talking about advisory fees here. The fee schedule covers administrative costs, wire transfer fees, account transfer out fees, inactivity fees, margin interest rates, physical certificate delivery fees.
It's basically a menu of all the annoying little administrative tolls you have to pay.
Precisely. And regulators require this menu to be incredibly transparent. The standardized fee schedule must be posted on the broker-dealer's public website without password protection. Any prospective client should be able to click on it and see exactly what it costs to wire money.
What happens if the broker-dealer wants to raise the wire fee? Let's say inflation is up and they want to increase the wire fee from $20 to $30. Can they just update the website overnight?
No, they must provide clients with advance written notice of any changes to the fee schedule. And the timeline is highly testable.
Well, guess the decoy. The exam is going to offer 60 days.
The exam will almost certainly offer 60 days or 90 days as decoy answers. The correct answer is 30 days. Changes to a broker-dealer fee schedule require 30 days advance notice.
30 days advance notice. Got it. Now, here's a trap I fell for when I was studying. If I want to know how much Sammy the broker is going to charge me to buy 100 shares of Apple, do I look at the fee schedule?
You do not. And that is the biggest conceptual trap of this section. Commissions, markups, and markdowns do not appear on the standardized fee schedule.
But they are fees. Why aren't they on the fee menu?
Because they are not standardized administrative costs. Commissions are transaction specific. The cost to execute a trade varies wildly based on the size of the trade, the liquidity of the security, whether it's an agency or principal transaction, and the difficulty of the execution. You cannot put a single flat number on a menu for that.
So when does Clara actually find out what the commission was?
Commissions and markups are disclosed separately on the trade confirmation, which is delivered after the execution of the specific trade. They belong on the receipt, not on the administrative menu.
The receipt, not the menu. That makes total sense. Okay, we have covered a massive amount of ground today. We followed Frank, Sammy, and Clara from the first deceptive LinkedIn post all the way to the final trade confirmation. To lock this in, let's do a rapid-fire recap of the most highly testable points we hit today. Listener, if you haven't taken notes yet, now is the time.
I am ready. Let's do it.
Testimonials and endorsements.
SEC-registered advisors are permitted to use them, provided they make strict disclosures about client status, compensation, and conflicts of interest. However, most state-registered advisors are still strictly prohibited from using them. Always check the jurisdiction in the question.
ADV Part 2 Brochure Delivery Timelines.
It is an either framework. Option 1, deliver 48 hours in advance of signing the contract. Option 2, deliver at the time of signing, but you must provide the client with a 5-business-day penalty-free termination window.
The assignment of contracts.
An advisor cannot transfer a client contract without explicit client consent. A majority partnership change, meaning more than 50% changes hands, is an assignment and requires consent. A minority change, 50% or less, is not an assignment and requires notification only.
The qualified client exception for performance fees.
The two thresholds are $1.4 million in assets under management with the specific advisor, or $2.7 million in net worth, calculated by completely excluding the value of the primary residence.
And finally, performance guarantees.
They are absolutely prohibited under the anti-fraud rules. Promising a client that they will break even is a prohibited guarantee of a specific outcome. The fact that a client requested the guarantee is not a valid defense. However, refunding your own advisory fee for poor service is entirely legal.
Boom. That is the cheat code to surviving this section of the Series 65. But before we sign off, I want to toss it back to you for a final philosophical thought. We've spent an hour bisecting rules, dates, thresholds, and exceptions. When a test taker is sitting in that quiet, sterile room, staring at a confusing question about a contract clause they don't quite remember, how do they navigate it conceptually? What is the North Star?
The North Star is recognizing the central vulnerability of the financial system, the asymmetry of information.
Asymmetries of information, meaning Frank and Sammy simply know more than Clara does.
Always. It is their full-time profession. They understand the math, the leverage, the hidden risks, and the complex fee structures. Claire does not. The law recognizes that inherent power imbalance. So when you look at the 48-hour delivery rule, or the ban on exculpatory waivers, or the requirement to show net performance next to gross, these aren't just bureaucratic hurdles. They are the architectural framework designed to prevent that knowledge gap from being weaponized. Without these rules, the asymmetry would inevitably lead to exploitation.
It's all about leveling the playing field.
Exactly. So when you are stuck on a difficult scenario question, don't panic trying to remember subparagraph C. Zoom out. Ask yourself, which of these answer choices rebalances the power back to the client? Which of these choices prevents the advisor from hiding a risk? If you analyze the question through the lens of protecting the vulnerable, uninformed party, the correct regulatory answer usually reveals itself naturally.
Rebalancing the power back to the client. I absolutely love that. When the memorization fails, look for the protection. You have the knowledge and the framework you need to crush this section of the Series 65. Trust your preparation, remember the chaotic lessons of Frank, Sammy, and Clara, and go ace that exam. Thanks for joining us on this deep dive.